share the same pain, all the mothers across the world that got shootings and police shootings for their sons. Hands up, don't shoot. I can't breathe. Please don't shoot. I want to grow up too.
And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for December 18th, 2014. I'm Esther Averam.
And I'm Michael Byfield.
On the Ground lifts up voices of activists and activism here in the nation's capital and around the planet. Well, from here in D.C. to Oakland, California and beyond, the nation has been shaken to its core by protests over police terror against African Americans, the broken criminal justice system, and increasingly against the economic apparatus underpinning this injustice. These were hot topics for the thousands of activists and protesters who descended on the nation's capital this weekend. And for this, our final on-the-ground show for 2014, there are also hot topics as we look back at this year and look forward to 2015 with author and activist Gerald Horn. And of course, we'll take your comments in the second half of the show. All of that is coming up, but first, our headlines.
Hundreds of attorneys have joined the nationwide protest over unpunished police killings of African Americans. The attorneys, many of them in business attire, stage a dying outside a Los Angeles courthouse, lying on the ground in the rain for 4.5 minutes, 1 minute for each hour that Michael Brown's body lay in the street after he was shot dead. Attorney Carmen Ocampo said lawyers have a particular obligation to speak out about the failure to indict officers who killed Michael Brown and Eric Garner.
Lawyers have felt anger and grief about what's been happening. And as legal actors, we feel a particular responsibility to call out and condemn the injustices in the criminal system and the racism. So as people who are sworn to uphold the law, we study the law, we enforce the law, we take oaths to uphold the law. We want to speak out against these practices in the criminal system that are racist and result in these failure to indict police who kill unarmed people.
About 200 public defenders did the same outside the criminal court building in Brooklyn, New York.
In other developments or protests related to police killings, in Ohio, the family of John Crawford, the 22-year-old African-American shot dead by police as he held an unloaded BB gun inside a Walmart, have filed a federal lawsuit against the retailer and the police department. Video published by The Guardian shows that after the shooting of John Crawford in Ohio, police aggressively questioned and threatened Crawford's girlfriend, who was in the store with him. As Tasha Thomas sobbed, police accused her of lying and threatened to jail her. Police questioned Thomas for more than an hour and a half before telling her that her boyfriend was dead. Congress has quietly passed legislation requiring states to report the number of people killed by police. The move follows a Wall Street Journal report that found police killings are virtually impossible to track, with hundreds missing from the FBI's tally. The reporting requirement was previously passed in 2000 but expired in 2006. More professional athletes have joined the growing movement against police violence. During warm-up Sunday, Cleveland Browns football player Andrew Hawkins wore a shirt which read "Justice for Tamir Rice and John Crawford." Both Crawford and 12-year-old Tamir Rice were killed by police in Ohio while holding toy guns. In a case that is just beginning to be picked up by some corporate media, after weeks of pressure from the NAACP, the U.S. Attorney for Eastern North Carolina announced Friday that the FBI had opened an investigation into the death of 17-year-old Lennon Lacey, who was found hanged from a swing set in the predominantly white trailer park where he lived in Bladenboro, North Carolina. A march through the town was held on Saturday. And at least 25 people were arrested as protesters shut down entrances to the Oakland Police Department by chaining themselves to the doors and locking their arms together at a nearby intersection. One activist climbed a flagpole and raised a banner showing the images of African Americans killed by police. And of course, activists from here in D.C. and Ferguson took the mic during Saturday's Justice for All march here in Washington, D.C. D.C. activist Erica Totten told On the Ground that she took action because Ferguson activists who ignited this national movement were not asked to speak at the march and were asked to leave a so-called VIP area at Freedom Plaza.
So we shut it down. We made sure that the people whose voices that needed to be elevated got that platform, because you know, with an event like that, and you don't have any people from Ferguson that are going to be speaking, people who started the uprising, it's a problem. And so to be able to talk about youth, but not have any youth really represented that are speaking, that are leaders there, then, you know, it's about pacifying those leaders and trying to dismiss those leaders and not giving them a platform. They didn't know who the Ferguson leaders were. They didn't even know who they were. So for people to not know Netta and DeRay and Lost Voices and not have them be a part of it, it's a problem.
In other activist news around the nation and the world, it's official. New York State will ban fracking after years of lobbying and aggressive public protest by state residents to make permanent short-term moratorium on the controversial oil and gas drilling practice. Governor Andrew Cuomo cited harm to public health as the key reason for the decision to announce an all-out ban. The potential impacts of fracking on water, air, land resources, community, and local services are significant, Cuomo said in a tweet just after the decision was made public.
Activists who have labored for more than a decade to free the members of the Cuban Five who remain in custody are rejoicing at the prisoner swap that occurred yesterday, which led to the freedom of Gerardo Hernandez, Luis Mendina, and Antonia Guerrero, who came to the United States to monitor the activities of violent groups of Cuban exiles who have caused great suffering to many Cuban families. Unarmed, the altruistic mission of the Five was to save lives and prevent more criminal acts against their people and also against U.S. citizens. They were released in exchange for U.S. intelligence officer Alan Gross and another U.S. intelligence source whose name was not released.
In Michigan on Monday, the Reverend Edward Pickney, a leader in the struggle for social and economic justice for the residents of Benton Harbor, Michigan, was sentenced to serve up to 10 years in prison on the basis of thin circumstantial evidence that a few dates had been altered on a recall petition against the city's mayor, James Hightower. The recall was prompted by the mayor's continued support for tax evasion by the Whirlpool Corporation, the Fortune 500 company and $19 billion global appliance manufacturer headquartered in Benton Harbor, Michigan. Pickney was also a leader in the fight against what he called an illegal ceding of Benton Harbor Public Park to Whirlpool and a development firm, which privatized the park and gentrified what prime real estate into a golf course and wealthy gated community on Lake Michigan, excluding the people that the property was deeded to serve. Support for Reverend Edward Pickney's appeal should be sent to his organization, Banco, 1940 Union Street, Benton Harbor, Michigan, 49022.
In international news, in Haiti, mass protests are continuing over delayed local and legislative elections, which were due to take place in 2011. The protests forced Haitian Prime Minister Laurent Lamothe to announce his resignation over the weekend. Protesters are now calling for President Michel Martelly to resign as well.
Human rights activists in Berlin, Germany, have filed a criminal complaint against the architects of the George W. Bush administration's torture program. The European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights has accused former Bush administration officials, including CIA Director George Tenet and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, of war crimes, and called for an immediate investigation by a German prosecutor. The move follows the release of a Senate report on CIA torture, which includes the case of a German citizen, Khalid El-Masri, who was captured by CIA agents in 2004 due to mistaken identity and tortured at a secret prison in Afghanistan. So far, no one involved in the CIA torture program has been charged with a crime, except the whistleblower, John Kerouac, who exposed it. And finally, in our culture and media moment, the Obama administration had confirmed that it will seek limited testimony from New York Times investigative reporter James Risen in one of the most significant press freedom cases in decades. On Tuesday, Risen was ordered to participate in a hearing early next month in advance of the trial of former CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling. Sterling is accused of giving Risen classified information that revealed a botched CIA plot to disrupt Iran's nuclear program. If Risen refuses to testify, he could be jailed.
And one of the leading musicians in Cuba has told the U.S. Agency for International Development to go to hell for ensnaring his son and other hip-hop artists in a botched plot to foment anti-government unrest. Silvio Rodriguez made the comments on his blog following revelations by the Associated Press that USAID tried to recruit Cuban rappers under the guise of civic causes like HIV prevention. And finally, locally, those wanting to support black artists and small businesses are invited to the 24th BZB Annual Holiday Gift and Art Show. This Saturday is the final week of the show, which features 75 local retailers and will join together to sell fine jewelry, designer and ethnic fashions, home accessories, original artwork, unique greeting cards, and all kinds of specialty items. The event is being held at the Shiloh Family Life Center, 1510 9th Street, Northwest, two blocks north of the Washington Convention Center here in Washington, D.C. Founder Juanita Britton said that people can find value close to home as well as good reason to shop locally this holiday season. And those are our headlines and our moment of culture and media. When we come back, more voices from the hundreds who gathered here in the nation's capital this weekend. Stay with us.
Did I want to come here? I honestly am not that big of a fan of all the politicians and all the men in the suits with the nice shoes and all of that behavior that happens in D.C. Like, I'm not impressed. So I really didn't want to come. I knew that the march was probably going to be some bullcrap, and I got exactly what I thought it was going to be, even worse. So at points, I was just so mad that I could cry. The fact that I see people with VIP passes at a rally on the day of resistance. Resisting never includes a VIP pass. Ever. A march, nothing. Like, you are not very, very important to who. Like, what's important is the fact that black people are being killed and have been being killed since the beginning of this country with no
recourse.
Nothing. There's no nothing. Nothing is happening. Not only are we talking about D.C., in St. Louis, not even just Ferguson, there are three dead black boys, and no one is trying to give us an answer for any of them. So to see fellow people who look like me tell me that I needed a VIP pass to even sit on a ledge at a rally was out of control. It's out of control. It is respectability politics, and I'm not for it. I, like Leon was talking about, respectable Negro. I wasn't a respectable Negro on August 9th. I did not put on a suit, a pantsuit, a church suit, some nice shoes to go and see about what happened to this rant, to this black boy I don't know. I didn't need that, and we don't need it now. I don't need Al Sharpton to speak for me in his suit and his tie, and I never will. I am not that. This is not the 1960s. This is not the civil rights movement. This will not look like what you want it to look like. This will not look like what your grandparents told you the civil rights movement looked like. None of that. We listen to Boosie. We listen to Webby. We listen to, I mean, Boosie plays nonstop.
At every protest. You'd be like, where's Boosie?
They're like, who's Boosie?
Right. Boosie is, listen, He's from Louisiana.
Every
I
protest.
Prayed for him to get out of jail because I'm a Boosie fan at heart before August 9th. And he was included in the movement. He has a great song.
I love it.
Called
Stop
the Police. Like, literally. And it was playing nonstop, bass everywhere in August. And people were just walking down the streets chanting our regular chants, you know, hands up, don't shoot. And then at the same time, you got another group over here rapping lyrics. And that's just what it is. 2014, black people are not the same as 1962, and we will not be. And so that's the main message I was pushing on Twitter today is what you're looking for is not here. If you don't like or support what we did yesterday, this is not the movement for you. It's not my job to convince people to care about black people dying in these streets. It's not my job to make people feel comfortable. I'm going to talk about black people nonstop. I'm black. That's what I know. So I'm going to talk about it. White privilege, I know very well. I went to all white schools. I went to Catholic schools. I went to schools out in the boonies. And all I saw was privilege. And in Ferguson, we make people. White people are white allies. When we call them to come, they come in numbers. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And when we tell them, time for y'all to get in the front. And they do it. They put their white privilege on the line. They get in front. They get that abuse. It's not the same confrontation. Because the police don't know what to do because it's so mixed. What do you do when it's 75-year-old white grandmothers with gray hair knitting sweaters and they in the front just knitting? And there's a bunch of black people behind them. You know, you want to get to the black people. But what do you do to these old white ladies right here, though?
This woman got arrested, and the officer goes up to her. He goes, ma'am, come with me.
There was a woman who got slammed and knocked unconscious, and they carried her off like she was hogtied, a black woman, in that same space. So, you know, even though it is a mixed crowd of people that are out there, the engagement with the police and the rules of engagement that police have for white people and black people are fundamentally different.
There was one protest recently a week ago with this white young man. He's probably like 22. It was at the Rams game. He was like coming from the Rams game, but he was a protester, so he joined us at the end. The police were getting crazy. They were macing people. They have these, I don't know if you've seen the picture, but the mace cans are like really, they're like really long. Yeah. So he's like pointing, he's like, I'm about to arrest you. And the white boy, he says, but you didn't tell me directly, individually to disperse. So we looking like, I have to see what the police are going to say. Because he said it, so I mean, it was like the most sincere. He was like, but you didn't tell me individually. And the officer goes, okay. You know, and I'm hyped. I'm like, we would have been under the jail if that was like. But like, and that is real, right? So like, it is this con. And he and the white boy, he knew it, right? He totally got it. He was like, I know that was my privilege. And we're like, I'm happy you know it, because you did not tell me individually. I cannot wait to say that to a police officer.
Mm-hmm. You hug your child?
Right, I'm gonna be. Y'all gonna see me on the news?
Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Rivera.
And I'm Michael Byfield.
You just heard a little piece of One Thing by Amarie. And before that, activist speaking this weekend from D.C., Erica Totten, from Baltimore, DeRay McKesson, and from St. Louis, Leon Kemp and Janetta Elzey. They were talking about their impressions of the Justice for All March here in D.C. and their own work on the ground, around the country, shutting it down. Now you're going to hear an interview we did yesterday with Gerald Horn, author, activist, professor at the University of Houston, about his impressions of the most important things that happened this year in 2014 and also looking ahead to 2015. As you look at the year, there have been so many things happening around police brutality, developments in Ukraine, Africa, Ebola. There's just so much happening around the world. Yesterday, there's this, well, I should say a reinitiation of diplomacy or diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba. The remaining members of the Cuban Five were swapped for Alan Gross. At the same time, the U.S. seemed to indicate that there would be new sanctions on Russia. So there's just so much going on in the world. I just can just start anywhere. But if we had to summarize for this segment, what would you say you want to include as the most important developments of this year?
Well, let's start with the marches in Washington, New York, and across the country in Oakland in particular, around the question of police violence. It's important not only because thousands of people have been on the march, but also because of some of the initiatives, that is to say, the young black folk in Chicago and the group We Charge Genocide, who went to testify at the United Nations on the question of torture. Likewise, for the parents of Michael Brown, who right after the U.S. election went to Geneva to testify on the question of torture. That's a very significant development, particularly in light of the fact that another important story was the Feinstein Committee report on torture, which garnered global headlines, and this raises the possibility of linking this domestic question of repression with this international question of repression. Another pressing issue, as you've already outlined, would be the question of Ebola, not only because it was used, I would say, in a spurious manner to gin up GOP turnout in the United States in the wake of one Ebola death, but also because of the more serious aspects, that is to say, the possibility and prospect of thousands more dying in 2015 unless some vaccine is developed or unless more adequate methods are developed to address this pandemic. You mentioned the crisis in Ukraine, and that's important because it's really upset the U.S. approach to global strategy. And I think you can draw a line from what happened in the Ukraine and early in the year to what's happening in Cuba and U.S. relations with Cuba resuming late in the year. When the Obama administration came into office, the idea was to do a reset with Moscow so there could be a pivot towards Asia. That is to say, the United States did not want to have conflict or unsteady relations with Russia and China at the same time. But that's precisely what's at play right now in light of the Russians moving into Crimea in particular and the upping of sanctions by the Obama administration. That ties into Cuba because what's happening now is that both China and Russia have a very strong toehold in Cuba. And from the point of view of Washington, this is not good news for U.S. national security. And in order to countervail Russia and China and Cuba, the United States now has to improve relations with Cuba. And this also has to be done in light of the fact that just like the United States has pivoted towards Asia, China has pivoted towards this hemisphere. There is enormous Chinese investment in Bahamas right off the coast of southern Florida. I've already mentioned Cuba. You know that in June 2013, President Xi Jinping met with all the Caribbean leaders, Jamaica, Trinidad, Barbados, etc., in Trinidad just before he went to Southern California to meet with Obama. So the United States somehow has to countervail that. And it's striking that just as the jailing of Nelson Mandela towards the end of his being incarcerated, in some ways he had turned into the jailer. That is to say, the apartheid rulers were isolated, and he was calling the shots. And somehow, in some way, that's what's happened with Cuba policy, because the United States has been checkmated by the Cubans to the point where they're isolated. And if the United States, or particularly U.S. imperialism, wants to deal with this new international situation with China and Asia, the number one economy in the world by certain measures, which has to be one of the major stories of 2014, well, then somehow they have to change relations with Cuba. I think another important development in December 2013.
We're still kind of talking about Russia, I was really interested in a few stories I saw about Russia and China kind of banding together to not use the dollar to trade their oil, to make their oil transactions. And I was wondering if some of these more recent sanctions and developments by the U.S. toward Russia had to do with trying to
to counteract or act against that possible move against the dollar?
Well, it's apparent that the United States feels, and this is in some ways consistent with what Mitt Romney was saying in 2012 during the presidential race with Barack Obama. Apparently, Barack Obama's moved to Mitt Romney's position, which is that Russia is the chief geostrategic threat of the United States, and that's why there's been this economic warfare against Russia, which has really caused the value of the ruble, the Russian currency, to plummet. Before the plummet, Russia was the eighth largest economy in the world. Now with the plummet, it's probably the 15th largest economy in the world. Certainly, there's concern about Russia in that regard. The fact that it moved into Crimea and that it's not playing the role that Washington set out for Russia, which was to be something of a plaything, like during the Yeltsin years, during the Clinton administration. Russia obviously has ambitions of its own and certainly does not include being a plaything of Washington. And as noted, probably the in historic terms, the chief story of the year is the fact that China's economy is probably larger than the United States economy. This is of historic significance. It's the first time since 1872 that the United States economy has not been the largest in the world. Of course, they're trying to downplay this in Washington and in Wall Street, but it's difficult to downplay such gargantuan news.
Okay, I think you were going to go on to the next point, and I interrupted you.
Well, just a few days ago, there was a story in the New York Times, a pullout quote, that said in light of the climate change talks in Lima, Peru that were then unfolding, that if there was not progress, there would be the possibility of human extinction. That means no more people like us, human beings. I found that a remarkable conclusion. And then Stephen Hawking, the British scientist, he made a statement just a few days ago during the same time that with the rise of artificial intelligence and computerized robots, that there was a possibility that once again, there's a possibility of human extinction with the robots taking over. It sounds like bad science fiction, I know, but those stories appearing almost one day after another in December 2014 certainly got my attention, particularly in light of the fact that we already know that there's a real challenge to the labor movement, given the fact that robots are taking over so many jobs in auto plants. There was a story just the other day about in hotels, robots delivering items to the rooms of patrons in hotels. We already know that in Southern California, you have computers that are writing stories for newspapers with only technicians feeding in data and then the computer spitting out of a story. So this is a major challenge to the labor movement at a time when the Republicans, as a result of this low turnout election, have just made significant inroads in Washington, and certainly they're not going to be in favor of job training, job retraining to deal with such a scenario.
Okay. Okay. Anything else for the new year? I mean, you kind of pivoted to what's to come. So do you have any other thoughts for 2015?
Well, in light of the torture report and in light of the fact that the International Criminal Court was forced to drop the indictment against the Kenyan president Uhuru Kenyatta, who probably did have blood on his hands, there is a movement developing the African Union to have African nations withdraw en masse from the International Criminal Court. And you'll have to watch out for that in 2015, because the International Criminal Court in The Hague seems like it only wants to indict Africans, even when there's massive evidence that George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, by his own admission, have sanctioned torture, which is a violation of international law, which, by the way, I should add, if I were a travel agent for any of these U.S. officials, I'd be very wary of sending them abroad because they may wind up like former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, who you may recall some years ago was detained in London because of a subpoena of a Spanish magistrate due to Pinochet's torturing and killing of Spanish nationals in Chile, where Pinochet was the dictator. So this raises some tantalizing possibilities that if we are not able to bring justice to Cheney, Bush, George Tenet at all, then justice might be brought to them by dint of another court in another country exercising universal jurisdiction.
Okay. Well, I've been speaking to Gerald Horn, professor, author, activist, and frequent commentator across the Pacifica Network. Thank you, Gerald.
Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition on WPFW 89.3, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Rivera.
And I'm Michael Byfield.
For the next segment, Gerald Horn, author, activist, and professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, will stay with us. But it's also your turn. You can call 202-588-0893 to raise your voice. 202-588-0893 will be the number to call to talk about any of the topics that we've discussed today, the growing movement around the country around police brutality, killings in the African-American community, and also your thoughts about the most important developments that have occurred in 2014 and as we go into 2015. If you've already called this week, refrain from calling, give someone else a chance. No profanity, keep your comments concise. Michael Byfield will be here to take your calls.
202-588-0893. Welcome back to the On the Ground edition of Community Comment. And again, we would like to welcome you to the show. We have Dr. Gerald Horn on. And what we want to ask our listeners to do is to call in and give opinions or what you consider to be the most important issues of 2014 or what you consider to be going to be some of the most important issues in the year 2015, looking forward. I know there has been quite a flurry of developments that has happened towards the end of the year. And again, our number here is 202-588-0893. Dr. Horn?
Yes.
How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Okay. A question I have for you: the BRICS Bank, which was being touted by the BRICS countries and spearheaded by China and Russia. I heard Esther had asked you about whether or not you thought it might have been an effort by the Western powers to either spite or sabotage that effort by punishing the ruble. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, certainly, as I noted in my previous remarks, Washington is quite concerned about the Russia-China relationship. And as a result, there's no doubt, as evidenced by the fact that President Obama may be in the process of signing a new sanctions bill against Moscow, that, as President Putin said in his year-end press conference, Washington wants to chain the bear. That is to say, it not only wants to chain the bear, as President Putin said, referring to Russia, but it also wants to skin it and hang it up as an effigy. Now, the BRICS Bank is very important for a number of reasons. One, it reflects the fact that the Washington-based institutions, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which are dominated by the United States and the Western European countries, are reluctant to recognize new realities that point to the rise of China, Brazil, and other nations who have economies that are larger than those of many of the Western European nations, although the latter have more voting power in those institutions. And so, therefore, China and the BRICS are moving to set up their own institutions. You should also know that recent evidence suggests that China is recycling a smaller amount of the dollars it's accumulated from trade with the United States. They're recycling less of those dollars in U.S. Treasury bills, which go to support the Pentagon and U.S. health care and the post office and all the rest. And this, with the incoming conservative Republican Congress, raises the possibility that the government may have less revenue, which will lead either to a rise in taxes, which the Republicans, unless it goes to the 1%, see as the mark of the devil, or it'll lead to a cut in programs. At the same time, China is spending more not only on the BRICS Bank and on an equivalent of the International Monetary Fund, but they have this new Silk Road proposal. For example, just recently, in a remarkable event that did not gain coverage in the United States, a train rumbled from China to Spain. This is remarkable. This is knitting together the most significant landmass on this small continent. I'm speaking of the Euro-Asian landmass. And with the European economies now slumping, this raises the possibility of China buttressing its already dominant position as the leading global power economically on this small planet.
Okay. Caller, your name?
Hi, my name is Marini.
Hi, Marini. And where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Washington, D.C., and I'm asking if Dr. Horn can please elaborate more on how Cuba has checkmated U.S. He started on that, and then the host asked if he could jump on something else, but I'd really like for him to elaborate more on that.
Dr. Horn?
A very important question. You have to understand what's happening dialectically. On the one hand, this is a victory for the Cuban Revolution, that is to say, this normalizing of relations, but it also reflects a new attempt at subversion. As Obama and the White House have acknowledged, the old attempts at subversion, such as isolation, have not worked, and so they're going to try a new attempt. Recall that just before Muammar Gaddafi was assassinated in late 2011, as a result of a NATO and U.S.-led bombing campaign, he had sought to normalize relations with the United States and North Atlantic countries, and so we saw how that ended up. And from Washington's point of view, they would like to see a replay in Cuba, although I tend to doubt if that will take place for a number of reasons. You should also know that in many ways this is a defeat for the United States, this recognition that the isolation policies have not worked. And therefore, you see the United States, like in a Hollywood movie, backing out of the saloon with its guns blazing. But it's backing out of the saloon nonetheless. Although we have to take note of the fact that just as sanctions are being eased against Havana, they're being heightened against Caracas and Moscow, two of Havana's leading allies, and so that has to be taken into account. You also have to recognize that as part of this U.S. retreat, you can't understand it without understanding the new role of China in the region. China has poured millions into the Bahamas, just off the coast of South Florida. You may recall that in June 2013, that the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, met with the Caribbean leaders, Jamaica, Trinidad, Barbados, in Trinidad, just before heading to Southern California to meet with President Obama. There is a tidal wave of Chinese capital pouring into the Caribbean region. Likewise, China has been meeting at all levels with the Cuban leadership, in particular the military leadership. And part of what's happening now with this normalizing of relations between Washington and Havana is a recognition that from the point of view of U.S. national security, that there needs to be a countervailing of not only this Caracas and Moscow influence on the island, but also the Beijing influence on the island. We have to be careful, however, because there are certain points that we cannot ignore. I mean, for example, as a result of this normalizing, you're going to see more U.S. capital pouring into Havana. That includes remittances, that is to say Cuban Americans sending money to their relatives. Given white supremacy historically in the hemisphere, this suggests that those of European descent in Cuba may benefit from this new relationship, more so than those of African descent, which can exacerbate class and race tensions on the island, which is, I'm sure, something Washington would like to see flourish. You also have to keep in mind whether or not this will have impact on regional tourism. That is to say that as a result of the normalizing yesterday, the stock of Carnival Cruises, the Florida-based shipping and voyaging company, skyrocketed. And historically, you may know that before the late 1940s, Cuba was the center of U.S. tourism in the Caribbean, and it was only after the 40s that Jamaica and these Montego Bay and these other regions grew in tourism. We have to consider what the impact will be on Jamaica and other Caribbean islands when tourism to Cuba escalates. And then finally, for the students and perhaps even the revolutionaries, we need to consider the historic question, which is that 50 years after the Haitian Revolution had commenced in 1791, you saw that the island of Hispaniola was in the process of being split with the rise of the Dominican Republic. A development, as I point out in my book on the subject coming out next year, was engineered in no small part by Washington. And yet 50 years after the Cuban Revolution 1959, you see that U.S. imperialism is retreating. And it would be very useful for students and revolutionaries to understand and answer that question of why the difference.
Next caller. Hello.
Good morning, Dr. Horn.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to say the situation created now, the division between the West and Russia, between the West and China, has created such a heartening possibilities for dictators in Africa, particularly in Ethiopia. The justice system of Sweden put on lots of high officials in the Ethiopian government on a warrant list. Now, this division has created such a situation. The Ethiopian dictators were showering bullets on cars on a car driven by Swedish tourists in Ethiopia. You see? So we should demand we should put a demand on all sides, saying human rights first, human rights before investment. That's what we should demand from all sides, not China, not Russia, not the West, on everybody. That's what we should demand. That is our only way of survival in Africa.
Thank you, Tesfa. Next caller.
Your name? Yes, Sammy. How are you today?
Excellent. Where are you calling from?
Dr. Horn from Washington, D.C. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
I would like to ask is that Dr. Horn is very nice knowledge you have in Africa right there. I like it shows there. And then personally, I was asking Dr. Horn, if you have knowledge about between Eritrean and the Ethiopian war for 2 years right there. After they got a peace signed by world leaders right there, the Ethiopians refused to accept that things eyewitness was there, and then they put Eritrea in sanctions. So what do you think about that?
Well, first of all, with regard to background on East Africa, I would point you to my book on Kenya, that is to say Mau Mau and Harlem, United States and Liberation of Kenya, which deals with the rise to independence of Kenya in the 1963, which has a lot of background on not only the Ethiopian struggle, but the Eritrean struggle as well. Secondly, with regard to the International Criminal Court, which was mentioned by a previous caller, you may know that President Museveni of Uganda is going to put a motion before the African Union suggesting that all African nations withdraw from the ICC because he has been so upset with the ICC going after the president of Kenya, Kenyatta, and the vice president, Ruto. It is a fact that disproportionately and overwhelmingly the ICC has gone after these African leaders, and it is also a fact that they've been rather hesitant and reluctant to go after the United States, even though the Feinstein report on torture lays out a brief and a roadmap for indicting George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, George Tenet, Condoleezza Rice, Stephen Hadley, and all the rest. And as suggested, I think if I were those individuals, I'd be very hesitant about traveling abroad because they may be detained. But in any case, the ICC is being weakened, and that's going to make it very difficult, as your previous caller suggested, for other leaders of Africa. He suggested the Ethiopian leaders, others might suggest the Eritrean leaders, to be brought before the ICC. I should also say that with regard to Ethiopia in particular, that there has been, a la the Caribbean, a tidal wave of Chinese capital pouring into Ethiopia, into East Africa generally. As you know, there have been trade routes from China to East Africa stretching back hundreds of years to, say, the early 15th century, when Zhang He, the Chinese admiral, sailed to East Africa. And, of course, there's archaeological evidence with regard to Chinese coins being found in that part of Africa. Indeed, there's evidence to suggest that there's a kind of offshoring taking place, where as Chinese wages rise, that factories from China are being reshored or offshored to Eastern Africa, which is something, it seems to me, that analysts of East Africa are going to have to consider. One final note on Somalia. As you know, there has been outrage in Nairobi of late because of this perception that forces from Somalia are engaged in what Nairobi would call terrorism, unquote, against Kenyan citizens. There's a documentary that you should be able to find on Somalia and what has been called piracy, called Stolen Seas. And it's a TikTok analysis of what have been referred to as Somali pirates and their seizing of ships from Western Europe and seeking to gain ransom. It's a very interesting documentary that has a surprise ending that I won't spoil for you.
Next caller. Hello.
Hello.
Your name and where you're calling from?
Yeah, my name is Kidani, and I'm calling from Washington, D.C. And I want to talk about the new development 2014 in Africa, specifically Eritrea. I think it's the same thing with Cuba right now. Well, Eritrea and Cuba are not the same, but there is a similarity of the massive Western propaganda to isolate, to sanction, to belittle the country. But lately, I guess the last 2 weeks, there has been a marathon of diplomacy by the Europeans, you know, bypassing the United States, you know, trying to engage with the country and try to assess the situation in the country. And when they found out, it's just, they debunked everything what was said on the Western media. Thank you very much.
Next caller. Your name and where you calling from?
My name is Tuhudi, and I'm calling from Alexandria, Virginia.
Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to say a hotel to you, your guest, Dr. Horn, and the PFW listening audience. Yes, Africa and the black diaspora right now is at the crossroads. We've either got to decide to do things for ourselves or be subjects to other nations besides the European colonial racist conquerors, and allow these other people to chop up and divide up Africa by investing on African soil. Why can't we get together as people in the West with the African nations and start doing things for ourselves? We have to make a stand right now. We can't allow other people to make investments for our future. We got to invest in our own future. And that is my comment.
Thank you. Dr. Horn, I would question for 2015 with the development of with Elizabeth Warren coming out on the Senate floor against Citigroup, and there's been a groundswell of progressive activity looking at Wall Street and in particular Citigroup.
Well, I salute Elizabeth Warren, who has been touted as a potential candidate for U.S. president. I salute Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who has been touted similarly and has been visiting the early caucus state that is Iowa. Certainly, their left-leaning economic populism is something that we must all welcome. But at the same time, I don't think we should put the horse before the cart either. That is to say that unlike many of our friends on the U.S. left, we should not ignore the fact that the Republicans in January will have their largest majority in Congress in 80 years, that in Dixie, the Deep South, 9 out of 10 Euro-Americans vote for Republicans in an amazing cross-class coalition that unites those defined as white or poor or working class or middle class and are part of the ruling class and the ruling elite, that in 2012, President Obama received a record low of votes from that particular community, about 6 out of 10 Euro-Americans of various class backgrounds voted for the Republicans. And it seems to me that some force, political force, in this country is going to have to grasp the nettle and recognize that that's a problem that cannot be ignored. Perhaps they need to be going door-to-door in these communities, engaging in the basics of political education. It should not be taken for granted, as apparently is taking place now, that these folks are secret left-wingers yearning to breathe free, but somehow they're being traduced and misled by leaders, which seems to be the dominant narrative. So in any case, once again, like yourself, at least this is what I interpreted, I salute Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, but I do think that we need some basic spade work to be done.
Okay, I want to thank all our callers that called in, and I want to thank Dr. Horn for his continued insight. All our callers, coming up will be Askia Mohammed and Chris the Property with Don't Forget the Blues. Peace, and have a great new year. Thank you.